looking for attributes that add value, ceiling height, what's popular in that street or that market. Is it open plan or is it accommodation that suits home office use? Yeah, because of COVID, work from home arrangements. Is it quite quirky? Like, is it an Art Deco type home where, you know, there's not much open plan, but people are liking all the ornate features of a home? What's creating value in that area? So if it was an Art Deco home, is it stucco rendered inside? Has it got marble fireplaces? Has it got 3 meter ceilings instead of the standard? Has it got ceiling roses, decorative cornices, picture rails? You know, really good solid walls and, you know, solid timber floors. What's creating the value, the demand driver for that particular product?
Hello and welcome to Dash Dot Insider, the auditory epicenter for passionate property investors seeking a life of freedom, choice, and abundance. I'm Emil Pinder, I'm your host today, and I'm joined by a very special guest. This is Anthony Salce, who is, and I don't say this lightly, probably the most qualified property valuer you could imagine. So we're going to get some real gold here. We're going to find out exactly how valuers assess properties, how they value them, and how a lot of people are trained, or how valuers are trained, because Anthony also does a lot of training work, how valuers are trained to assess properties. Most importantly, we're going to find out how you can add some more equity to your property. But first up, a little bit of an intro. Anthony, do you want to tell us about yourself a little bit?
Yeah, fantastic. Thanks for having me on the show. I've been a certified practicing valuer since around 2006. I've been working at Optian for most of that period. I've worked at a few other firms as well, but I've been at Optian for most of that time. I've also worked as an analyst for non-ADI lenders, so private lenders that are lending money to construction development projects and things like that. So I've been a certified practicing valuer. I basically assessed across most of metropolitan Melbourne. Yeah, my earlier years was in the west and the north, and then I did a big bulk of it in the east in Melbourne, and now I've covered pretty much most of Melbourne. I specialise now in the prestige space and the non-mortgage family law space. So I've been doing a lot of valuations representing families in dispute or separating in the family law space, the advisory, so capital gains tax valuations, pre-purchase advice valuations. I'm dealing in that landscape at the moment, which is really exciting. But in the mortgage space, I cover anything from small subdivisions to, you know, land banks to prestige valuations, units, apartments, as I mentioned before, your standard sort of properties, and some held on one title. There might be two or three units that someone wants to acquire and hold in a super fund. I do that sort of work as well. So it's quite exciting. It's a great industry to be in.
Yeah, well, we all love property. So you mentioned Melbourne a lot. Now, for anyone listening that might be in Queensland, they might be in Sydney, might be in Perth, Adelaide, wherever, how different is the valuation process in the different states? Is it pretty much the same, or are we looking at
something? It's a little bit different. It's a little bit different. So Optian as a firm covers all of Australia, 98% of all postcodes in Australia. Each area's got their own legislative requirements as far as what you can and can't do on the land. As far as being a valuer, in Victoria, there's various tiers. There's like an RPV and a CPV. So what that means is there's a residential property valuer that in the mortgage space can value up to $2 million and can value most residential standalone properties in that space. That's not like a student accommodation or a service department, that's just a standard residential property up to $2 million. And there's a few other requirements to that. And then you can be what's called a certified practicing valuer, which means you can value commercial, industrial, residential, retail, hospitality, all the main asset classes. In Queensland, as an example, there's no RPV. You have to go straight to CPV qualifications. So various states have different like requirements to what you can and can't do.
So aside from the requirements of what valuers can and can't do, in terms of the process for going in and valuing a property, we're talking it's pretty similar across Australia?
Yeah, pretty similar.
Okay, all right. So the advice that you're giving us today, that's going to be applicable in Brisbane, Gold Coast, Sunny Coast, correct. Rockhampton, everywhere. Okay, yeah, awesome.
Everyone's got their different drivers and legislative requirements, but the process to what we do to understand that is generally the same.
All right. Well, let's jump straight into how you actually perform evaluation. So when you're doing an on-site evaluation, a desktop one, what's the process that you go through, and what does it look like when you first sort of rock up to the property, or do you do anything beforehand? Can you talk us through that?
So there's a lot of what we call pre-prepping that happens at home. Yeah, so most valuers will work remotely. And generally speaking, when you're working in the mortgage space and the advisory space, but Optium being a very large mortgage provider, there's a lot of data that we already have. So if we were doing like an apartment complex, chances are we've conducted valuations in that complex before, and we would do a lot of pre-diligence in that space. So what would that look like? Owners Corporation, have we been received on any other job the minutes to see if there's any cladding issues or any excess owners corporation fees or levies that may be attributed to that building? Is there any repairs that are coming up in those minutes? We have all that information up front. But if it wasn't an apartment complex and it was just a standalone home, as an example, keeping it quite simple, what I would do when I first get the job is I'd look at the letter of instruction, make sure what I'm doing it for. Is it for mortgage? Is it for pre-sale advice? What's the purpose? And then say it was just, you know, because that could be different.
That's a factor in the valuation. If the person is trying to get it revalued so they can pull some equity out, or if they're looking to sell it, or...
Oh, it depends. Like sometimes we're doing a valuation for capital gains tax purposes and they might require the date to be 5 years ago. Okay. And that might... There might be different legislative requirements that have changed in that 5 years. So I need to look at everything retrospectively. You know, if it was for mortgage purposes, it's a different template and I have to work within different framework. The valuation figure should generally be the same, but the purpose could be for different reasons. Someone might be renovating the home and they want to know what it's worth today if I did these, this and this and this and this and this. So understanding the purpose will dictate the pre-work that's required, you know. So as an example, someone might be looking at building a home, a new home on it, and it might be 400 square meters of land, or it might be 298 square meters of land. And the process to be able to do that might vary based on the size, you know, and I might be giving advice on that. So understanding the purpose is really important. So say it's just pre-purchase advice. You know, someone wants to know what it's worth. I would look into the zoning, the overlays. I'd get a title search. Is there anything on the title that's going to impact its value? Is there anything on the plan of subdivision that's going to impact its value? Is there anything on the street that we've done previously in the system that's going to flag concerns on value? Like, is it next to a petrol station? Is it next to a childcare center? Is it near a train line? Is it near power lines? Is there anything that's going to have a real detriment on the value? Is it near in a zoning that's got highest and best use is apartments? So someone might pay a premium for the land, but you're also going to be surrounded by high rises. You know, what's around the area that's going to have immediate impact? Because what we're essentially trying to do is de-risk the valuation straight away.
Right, there's a lot to consider. I guess the majority of people, I imagine, that are listening to this are thinking the main purpose is going to be remortgaging, to pull equity out, to try to buy their next purchase. So making sure that they are able to present the property and that a valuer is going to come along and go, yeah, well, it's grown by this amount, is going to be really important. So hopefully most of the factors that you just mentioned have already been covered in the initial purchase if people have been buying through us. So we should be pretty good with all of that stuff. And then the exciting part comes when you drive up to the property.
Yeah, exactly. So if you're an owner looking to pull out equity to get their next property and you're going to use sales evidence in around the area, that's what a valuer is going to look. They're going to look at the most directly comparable sales. And some owners get really excited and go, well, the property around the corner sold for 1.5. Mine needs to be worth that too. Is that property directly comparable? Is it the same zoning, same overlays, same land size, same school zone, as an example? You know, does it meet all the same requirements that's going to allow you to get a valuation equity uplift? And then we would compare the same as value. So we would look at a very important factor would be the conditions of that sale. Was it purchased at an auction? Were there five bidders? What were the underbidders? Is there strong demand for that asset? Or was it actually an expression of interest and there was two bidders and the two prices were very different from one another? So understanding those attributes of the sale, the conditions of the sale, how it actually transacted, you know, because sometimes you might find that a property sold for 1.5 around the corner, but it was purchased by the adjoining owner and they've got a very different use to what you can do. So it's about understanding that highest and best use and does it align with your property?
Okay, so there's a lot more to it. Like if someone has a $600,000 property or if they bought it for, say, $400 and now they believe it's worth $600, there's a lot to going into, is it actually worth the $600? Now, I would think, I mean, there are a lot of exceptions. There are a lot of cases where some people might be looking at, yeah, say it's the next door neighbor who's bought it because they've got plans to put their daughter in there, or maybe to demolish it and turn it into something else, you know, put in a man shed or whatever it's going to be, right? A massive swimming pool, whatever it is, they can do that. So there are those cases, and I imagine there's quite a few of them. The vast majority of cases, how often roughly do you see these kind of extra things popping up that can change the valuation from what people are looking at around the corner? Or another way of asking that question is, like, how much should people really rely on other sales in the area of the property that they're looking to get valued?
A lot of the time it's based on comparable evidence. Now, as a valuer in the mortgage space, you have to have 3 settled sales, and then you can and you also consider the most current. The reason for that is, yeah, sometimes those current sales might be sold subject to finance and they fall over, and then it sells for a different price. So they want to make sure that you've got some certainty on unconditional sales that have settled. And they want to also make sure that you're also comparing it to the most relevant data in the market. So there's a combination of relevancy, and then also settled sales that have actually transacted, swapped hands, keys are gone, it's all been settled, so that you can actually rely on that sale heavily. So there's a combination of two.
If we're looking around at, say, realestate.com.au, that I imagine a lot of people are doing, and they go to the sold section, that'd be a reasonable area to be looking around. And
I use it every
day. Order by most recent.
Yeah, I use it every day. I look at that. I look at CoreLogic. There's other sites that evaluators use, like Property Data Align, that we subscribe to. And we look at all those assets. CoreLogic's another one that we use quite frequently. We have subscriptions to it, but that also has information relevant to valuers that the local market doesn't. That insights that we subscribe to, basically, that can make a. But we also rely heavily as valuers in the mortgage space on properties we've personally been in. Yeah, so that, because we've measured them, we've got the true look of the home. It's not rental furnished anymore. It's not staged. It's as the home was, and we can see all the intricacies and things that they've done to the home, and discuss what's been done to the home and get a bit more intel.
Right. All right. Well, let's move on then to what happens when you arrive at the property. What does the process look like when you get there? When you're walking through it, what kind of things are you looking to assess straight up?
So normally I obviously first get there, greet the owner, let them know that I'm here, and then I'll go through the home first in case they've got to leave and it's time constrained. So I try to appease their needs straight up front. But I generally, the things that I'm looking at up front, the frontage, that can play a big role in the demand for the asset, because it can appeal to different people. As an example to that appeal, if you've got a wide frontage that could suit subdivision, and you've still got a great home, someone might rent that, an investor might take it on a land bank perspective, a downsizer but still might want the small home, and you've also got a developer interested. So you've got people competing. So the frontage is important. The zoning, the overlays, I've already done that in the pre-research. But then I'm looking at the streetscape. Is it a tree-lined street? What are the neighbouring homes doing? Are they similar? Is it a highly congested street, or is it a pretty good homogenous street where there's good off-street parking facilities on every home? There could be a single dwelling covenant in the whole street, so you know that the streetscape's going to maintain as it is. Or is the highest and best use, if I look down the street, are they all going chopped up into 2-unit sites? Then you start to know what the demand is for that street. Is it really for a home, or is it really for subdivision? I look at all those characteristics when I get through the street. I do a little bit of a drive around. Then once I've said hello to the owner and I'm on site, and I'm going in the home now, you know, I'm looking at floor plan is really important. Looking for attributes that add value, ceiling height.
Tell me about the floor plan that you just mentioned.
Yeah, so like what's popular in that street or that market? Is it open plan, or is it accommodation that suits home office use? Yeah, because of COVID, work from home arrangements. Is it quite quirky? Like, is it an Art Deco type home where, you know, there's not much open plan, but people are liking all the ornate features of the home? What's creating value in that area? So if it was an Art Deco home, is it stucco rendered inside? Has it got marble fireplaces? Has it got 3-meter ceilings instead of the standard? Has it got ceiling roses, decorative cornices, picture rails, you know, really good solid walls and, you know, solid timber floors? What's creating the value, the demand driver for that particular product?
How much can those changes that you just mentioned in terms of like the characteristics of the floor plan in the home, how much of a difference in price can that make? Are we talking 5%, 10%?
I can't really quantify if it's 5 or 10, like a ratio. We don't really deal in that space, but I would be looking at the evidence and going, what does the evidence tell you? And generally speaking, you know, people are liking at the moment. They're liking that work from home arrangement. They're liking a dedicated office space that they can shut that door and move on. But they're liking the open plan space too. They like the high ceilings, and they will pay a premium for something that we call as value as turnkey, already done. I don't have to do anything to it. So because of the inflation of costs at the moment, delays with construction, people are wanting to be able to move in now and not have to worry about other risks of how long is it going to take? Do I have to move out? Do I have to rent for longer while I do these works? They just want to be able to move in right now. So they're paying a premium for that freedom of being able to do that straight away.
To use a personal anecdote, my wife generally gets a pretty big say in what houses we buy. And for her, and I've spoken to other mates of mine, they're like, yeah, it's my wife that she gets the big call on it, right? Because I'm easier to please, and most of my mates are easier to please than their wives, if I can say that without sounding a bit rude. So, and my wife has said, you know, it really comes down to the kitchen and the bathrooms. That those seem to be really, really massive factors. The laundry as well. Okay, is that just me and my mates who are like that, or is this something that you see
Pretty common. So okay. When you're going through a really good home and you see that it's sold really well, and you're looking at things that made it sell well, you know, if you're already walking through and you're comparing like with like, and ruling period homes as an example, the ceiling height's going to be popular, but they're all the same. They're all 3 meters. They've all got ceiling raises. But when you're looking at the bathrooms, that functionality, that storage, you know, a guy's going to have, you know, standard, you know, generalization I'm making, but they're going to have a comb, a shaver, some cologne, pretty much a toothbrush, right?
A bar of soap, and all that sort of stuff.
Yeah, but you know that the heat lamp, you know, the storage for hair dryers, straighteners, mirrors, makeup, all that freedom, the desk space on the bench top, all that type of stuff, because they're putting makeup on it. Is it going to be porous? Is it not? That all makes a big difference to the aesthetics of the home. Natural light for makeup, all those sorts of things create an environment that's productive. Yeah, and same with the kitchen. They want that big open plan bench space, really good storage for pots and pans. You know, access to other parts of the room. Like some people love a kitchen that goes into a laundry, then out to the garage, so that everything's designed in a way that is practical. You know, so you know they've got their dishwasher that goes out into their walk-in pantry, that goes out into their laundry, that goes out into the garage. So when they do their shopping, they can bring it in. It's right there. They can bring it right into that station. They can put it away. They like that practical application to living.
So I guess we're moving into the real meat of what we wanted to talk about today, and that is, what are the best and most effective ways for people to add value to their properties so that when the valuation comes in, they're going to be getting a lot more? So what are key things that you can do?
Yeah, so I'll go like really simple, and then I'll go a bit more complex just to give you a bit of to and fro. So if you've got a house that's got really bad light, natural light's a big thing at the moment. Yeah, you know, people are into their mental health. People are into how they feel when they wake up and how they can work and all that sort of stuff. So if you've got minimal light, you want to create a sense of a well-lit home. So how do you do that with, you know, high voltage downlights? All these sorts of things. You know, the paint tone can make a big difference. As you can see behind me, I'm in a study at the moment, and I've two-toned it to make it look, you know, that's a relatively cheap exercise to do. I put those chair railings in myself. I painted the bottom one color, painted the up one color, did that all myself, relatively easy, you know, all through Bunnings tools. And that creates detail that people will pay for, you know.
How much would you have spent doing that? And did you do it through the whole house or just the room?
I looked on YouTube at the hack situation. I thought it'd be really easy. So I tried it on a room where I could shut the door if I mucked it up. Right. So I did it that way. But so I've only done one room as a trial room, you know, to want to do more to it. And yeah, like the paint was a couple hundred dollars. I bought a nail gun for a couple hundred dollars. The moldings probably cost me a little bit more because it's a bit of trial and error. You know, I had to learn how to do it. But yeah, there's timber filler there, there's putty filler there, and sandpaper, and a couple of rollers. You know, so you know, you're looking at, you know, $600-$700. And if you're doing an apartment, you know, like a two-bedroom apartment, you could do that throughout the whole home because it's not a big space. You could do that and make it look really detailed really quickly. So it's creating that sense of detail. You know, it looks more luxe than it was.
Right. If you're doing it on a 4-2-2 house or a 3-2-2, your three bedrooms, two bathrooms, double lockup, and you might be looking then at a price maybe around $2,000,
yeah,
to do the whole
like
lot.
That. Yeah, if you did it yourself. Yeah, I mean, if I was to pay a painter to do this room, that would probably cost me $2,500 a room. You know, yeah, and I did it for like probably $500. You know, as an example, so it's just saving that's where you can make some quick wins and that on saving on labor and stuff like that. But they will do it quicker. So you got to look at time value for money. You know, like, can I be earning more money while doing it, or could I save money by doing it?
And what sort of uptick would you expect in the valuation from doing something like that?
So, like, just yeah. So what it does is, if you've cosmetically enhanced the home, you put really good lighting in it, you've done this sort of decorating. So then when you go to sell the home and you've gone and staged it with a proper staging company and you've made everything match, people can really get a sense of space of what they can do. They can get a sense of what can I do to this home? And it creates that competition. They go, I can move in and I've got the study sorted. It looks great. I can make it look elegant. It creates that reality of what I can do with the home. If it was very vacant and bare, you're not going to create that. Some people can't visualize it themselves. So you're trying to take away any doubt. So the more you can eliminate doubt of things I have to do eventually, the more uptake you'll have on a home. But to give you a really good win on a win example of cosmetic updates, but it cost about, according to the owner at the time, it cost about $80,000. So what they did in that scenario, they had a two-bedroom Art Deco home, right? One-bedroom Art Deco home. The floor plan was entry, lounge room, they had a bedroom, and then they had a kitchen on its own. So not a kitchen, it was like just a kitchen. And then the lounge room was like a lounge dining, you know? And then they had a bathroom with a laundry in there, right? So they kept the floor plate, they didn't take away any walls or anything like that. They renovated the bathroom, they painted the whole place, and they, where the kitchen was, they converted that kitchen into a bedroom. So where the sort of like fireplace bench stove was, they turned that into a desk, and they made that into now a two-bedroom, one-bathroom home. Where the kitchen, where the lounge is now, they put like a L-shape along the wall, an L-shaped kitchen, and they integrated into the brick wall a fridge, like a really small fridge. But they've turned that now into a fully renovated two-bedroom, one-bathroom home, and they purchased it very run down for around the 470 mark. They said they spent about $80,000 on it, and they sold it for around the 730 mark a year later.
Okay.
It's a good uplift.
It'd probably cost them all up about $550.
Yeah, with stamps and everything else. And yeah,
with stamps and everything else, it'll be a bit more.
Yep.
But purely in terms of the purchase price plus the cost of renovation.
Yeah.
Then you're looking at about $550 odd.
$550, yeah.
Yeah. And then it's up to $730 over the course of 1 year. So yeah, That's a hell of a lot.
You know, really good win. The key takeout there was a 60-something square meter one bedder, so it was a decent size to begin with. So to allow for that conversion to work, that was the key metric. And because it was Art Deco, yeah, it's really popular near, and you find a lot of them in Melbourne near the water, like Elwood, places like that where people want to be. It's very transient, very popular, good rental market out there. Public transport's good.
Just one win like that can really set up your whole portfolio. If you can find that right property for around the 470 mark, you've got access to $80,000 that you can probably get a valuer in to value what they think it'll be worth afterwards, so that you can get the funding to do the reno.
And that's what I was battling with when I valued it, because I valued the end result, right? And I was looking at it going, you only paid $480 for it. How can it be worth $730? Yeah, like you only, and I'm looking at the evidence going, that's what it's worth, you know? And I was speaking to the local agents going, you sold that one, it's the same size as this one. How many bidders? And this is this the demand for that asset. You wouldn't have got away with it with a 70s home or a 60s home. Maybe I think because it was Art Deco and it had all those extra ornate features, it already had demand for what it was. And converting it to a two-bedder, you've made such a better income-producing asset. And it was just It's just a more practical floor plan. A term, a kitchen that you just literally cook in for half an hour a day to a home office or a bedroom. Yeah, it's made it more practical.
And so I would imagine that the rents that they're able to achieve would also be commensurate with the price. So if they were yielding 5%, maybe they were getting $470 a week, maybe $500 or something like that. Now they're up at maybe the 700, 750 mark as well. So they're getting another $300 in cash flow.
And all they had to do, yeah, and also now you've also done this renovation, if you're renting it out, you've got all the tax depreciation elements of it, and all those sort of benefits too. So that was good. You know, if they built that to owner-occupy for a long period of time, or 4 or 5 years, there probably wouldn't be any capital gains either if you're living in it, you know, as an example. So there's other strategies you might have that for that uplift, to mitigate the uplift.
If you're an investor, how long would it take to do something like that? Was that like a 2-week project, 5-week, couple of months? How long to get it all done?
When they did that back then, it would have been a bit longer because of COVID constraints. But if you did that now, it's just about lining it all up, you know. So, you know, if you've got the right trades in place, you could do a bathroom. There's people out there quoting for 3-week turnarounds. You know, it all comes down to getting access to the materials. How quickly can you be onto the materials if there's no delay? Getting access to the materials, waterproofing, making sure you've got trades that can waterproof and do those elements quick. Because they weren't taking out any walls and they're not changing the footprint of the bathroom, like I want the toilet here instead of here, because they kept the carcass as it was, you can do that work relatively quickly. It's once you start moving the plumbing underneath the surface and realigning, I want the kitchen over here and the bathroom here, and I want to put it, that's where it can be a bit delayed. So the kitchen would have probably been the longest time there, because you're moving it from where it was and replumbing it to where it is. That's probably the longest consideration.
So a lot of properties might not need something as significant as shifting an entire kitchen. Let's say someone has a 3-bedroom home, something like that, just a 3-2-2, but the lounge is fairly large. They might be able to drop in an extra wall and create a little bedroom out of more space. A renovation on the bathroom, that sort of thing, those can create real uplifts.
And it's just being smart, knowing what your audience is. So doing that little DD, what would a 4-bedroom rent out for versus a 3-bedroom? What are the 4-bedrooms selling for, and how big are they? Because you are losing living space. So some people do prefer in a market a bigger open plan living space as opposed to more bedrooms. So you need to know what the market in the area is doing. Who's your audience? Is it going to be a tenant? If it's going to be a tenant, as an example, you might be, and an investor's going to only buy that product, they're going to look at how much I can charge per room. They want to fill that space. But if you're a family orientated area, owner occupier area, they're going to look at what I can do in this room. Is there enough? Is two living areas can be a great separation between teenage kids and parents. So it's like sometimes you've got to look at what the market is wanting to do in that particular time, and price accordingly, so you're not overcapitalizing.
Okay. This is really interesting. I think the key message that I'm getting is the better you can produce a home or style a home, renovate a home to what the market really, really wants. So if you can find something that's not quite right for what the market wants in a particular area, but you can see the potential to upgrade it to something that the market really, really wants, that's where it sounds like you can get the biggest lift. How close am I?
Yeah, I reckon that's it. And how much you're willing as a person, as an investor, to wear that risk, you know, because some of it's uncertain, right? When that person did that 2-bedroom conversion, I hadn't seen anyone else do that. So he had the confidence in his partner, had the confidence to give that a go. They said, look, it makes sense on paper. Let's give it a go. And it worked for him, you know. And he had the benefit of a booming market. He timed it right. So he had the benefit of uplift as well. And he just sold it in a time where the 2-bedroom was more demanding. You know, COVID was, at the moment, like some of the 1-bedrooms, not that they're not demanded, but people are wanting and preferring, because of COVID, a work-from-home arrangement. So they don't want their bedroom to be their office. They want to have that second room. And they won't be able to sublet, so that if they do go lockdown again, they've got company. Then they also want balconies. They also want car accommodation, because all these things, they all started buying luxury cars. Where am I going to put it? You know, they wanted to be able to go out when they were in lockdown, sit on a balcony and get access to fresh air. So all these things are still relevant. So he ticked all those boxes at the time, you know, and of what people wanted.
All right. So I would imagine a lot of people listening today are going to be thinking, well, I've got my home, or I've got an investment property, and if they're anything like me, the mind is absolutely racing with, what can I do here that can, you know, might cost me $10,000, but it's going to get me an uplift in 40. I might be able to mortgage, remortgage, pull 30 of that out. I'm on my way to my next deposit, my next property purchase, and then I could just keep on going and keep on going. What about things like the backyard? Is that a factor?
Yeah, definitely. So, you know, some people buying a property, you know, they're looking at, you know, what does it come with? Yeah, and what COVID created was all boxes what they want to be ticked. So they want, you know, they work from home, as I mentioned before, adequate car accommodation, as before. Even now, in Melbourne particular, there's a lot of theft happening in cars. So people are wanting that off-street parking at the moment. You know, that's becoming a big thing. You know, when you look at backyards, what entertainment areas do I have? If there's a lockdown, what am I going to do to fill in that space? Is there an outdoor entertaining area? Is there a pool? Is there a spa? Is there outdoor kitchens? What facilities do I have in the backyard? So when you're looking at though a house with uplift, that's what people are looking for. If it's in a school zone, you know, a prominent school zone, and you're renting it out, what are those children going to do in their backyard? Because people are going to pay a rent for that, you know, that freedom. So on a yield perspective, you know, it's going to help pay off your mortgage. So you want to look at what you're going to do to most enhance it. But you can do little things as well, very, very quick fixes, you know, like you know, edging, you know, like small garden beds, you know, things that create a sense of completion. People want things complete.
That's the word. That's the word. I've been mulling over like how best to express this. It feels like when you have a property, it's got this, it's got this, it's got this, but it doesn't have this. The second that it's kind of missing something, I mean, if it's got everything and it's complete, then it's an easy job for the valuer, because the valuer can go in and just say, okay, it's got this, it's got everything. Okay, well, that one over there was valued at 550, but this is better because it's a little bit more complete. Okay, we'll give it 600, or we'll give it 580, it feels like that. But if there's something missing, if it's a carport instead of a garage, or if it doesn't have any parking or something like that, when you're going down from the 550, that's where it feels more like guesswork, and you're at risk of getting a low val, because the valuer might not necessarily, like, how much do you take off? How important is that in a particular area? And it becomes a lot more subjective at that point, and it's much harder, not for you because you've been doing this for ages. But, you know, not everyone has your skill set who's valuing properties, right?
But the funny part about that is not everyone has our skill sets, and sometimes they pay prices for properties that we use as evidence. You know, so what's interesting, I hope, like, that becomes the, what we start to assess the mistake, right? So like, in knowing the market now versus before. So as an example, you're saying with the uplift, if I saw all these cracks in the home and behind me, and the paint was really old and there was things wrong, right? You know, generally speaking, as a rule of thumb that we're seeing in the market is they're taking longer to sell because people have that construction fear. Yeah, is the builder going to go under? Is there default risk? Is there delay risk? Is there cost inflation risk? All those things, right? But if it's already done for them, you know, they'll pay the premium. So if you can save on labor and do those things yourself, you know, there's an element of uplift in that. So you, because some properties are sitting there for longer if they require a lot of cash injection. So if you can do that stuff yourself, you're handy, and you've checked the bones, you've got a building and pest inspection, and everything's sound, it's just old, and you can do those enhancements yourself, well, then there's good uplift. But if you're, because the buyers today are wanting that turnkey product. So that's that consideration. But, like, to give you an example of market shift is changing, in COVID, yeah, what I was experiencing, I'll give you an example. I'm going to make up the figure, but it was a 10% difference roughly, right? So, because I can't remember the price, but it was in Essendon, and the property sold during COVID for around, I'm going to say 2.2, something like that, right? It was a townhouse, the front one, but it would look like its own home. So it was on a corner block. So the other townhouses at the back had its own access, and this was the front one on the corner. You know, it had off memory, most of the land was at the front, and it had like a double garage at the back and a small courtyard, and that was pretty much the home. It may have had a pool, but I can't quite remember. But, you know, a premium was paid at the time just to get in the suburb. It could have even been purchased sight unseen. It was all about just getting a good home in the suburb, in the area, close to, you know, the relative school zones that you're in within, and getting into a suburb. Yeah, after COVID had happened and the market had, you know, started to slow down a little bit, there started to be interest rate rise pressures and all that. Everyone, and the doors were open, you know, you could get into homes and see them. You went under that rush. You know, people were going, well, actually now, you know, there's not much backyard here. Most of it's in the front. I really want a backyard now. Now that there's less urgency, I'll wait for the right property. And all of a sudden, that property came back. It resold a year later or a couple of years later for 10% less. So they took a hit on it because the market driver had changed. Before, it was just get in the right suburb, in the right zones, to the school zones, in the right position or amenity. And sometimes they'd buy like an inferior product for the area just to get in, you know, and I'll deal with the rest later. That market's changed.
So does that mean, like, basically, we really need to be looking to the future and try to work out what is going to be in demand and what are going to be the key drivers for people's purchasing decisions? Because even if we're not going to sell our own properties, right, because we're investors, right, we've got our property, we're not really looking to sell it and make sure that it's presentable and it's going to sell quickly. We're just trying to get it up to spec so that it's comparable to other properties and it's complete, so there aren't any question marks that the valuer can subjectively sort of like point at any old number. If that's the case, then we're really just looking to make sure that we are providing what is going to be selling for a really good price in a year or two.
Yeah, and
crystal ball factor.
It's crystal ball factor, but there are ways you can use information now to know what's happening. So as an example, you know, if I was doing a certain area that was high-rise orientated or subdivision orientated, is my view, I can't tell what's going to happen in the future with my property. I can't predict the values, but is my view going to be enhanced or lost? Like if I've got a really nice city view and everything down that space is deemed for high-rise and I can lose it, I can do online searches and work out through council websites and things like that if there's any development approval in place to lose that view. And there might be something like a height restriction up to 15 metres on that zoning. Go, 15 metres, that's going to be really big. And there's and looking at the history of that area, I'm going to lose my view. Maybe I'm going to get out now and cut my losses on a loss. Yeah, because the view's there now and someone might buy it and be okay to have it for 4 or 5 years without that view being lost. So you've got to look at those things. Like that's really big in apartments. You know, like is there any fear of any loss of view? That's a really big one because there's a lot of old warehouses and factories and stuff that are becoming obsolete now and people are buying them to put developments there. And that could be literally in between you and a city view or in between you and a bay view or in between you and a parkland view. So these are the type of things you want to consider. And you can de-risk it by looking at the zoning and the future use of that land.
Okay. Are there any things in a property that you would not recommend renovating? Would you be like, nah, leave it, flack that away?
Yeah, understanding the highest and best use. So like if I'm looking at something in a home, right, as an example, right, to converting a, depending on the area, obviously, but converting a laundry into a butler's pantry, as an example, what's more important? Do people really want a laundry separated from food or they're happy to have a laundry in the garage and have a walk-in butler's pantry? Like understanding what the market wants. But like I did a valuation recently where someone spent a heap of money on a rear bungalow. You know, when I did my inquiry about that bungalow, it was actually a self-contained, it was actually a dependent unit. So upon the expiry of that dependent unit, that property has to go. They don't have permit approval to keep it. So someone's gone and spent money. That's something the council could knock on the door once the person leaves and says, you've got to leave now. It's not dependent anymore. That's not a second dwelling that you can keep. So they spent money on something that adds no value. So as a valuer making their inquiry, that bungalow adds nothing, you know, because it's got to go at the expiry of that dependence. But some That's people keep news. It. Yeah, some people keep it and they think, oh, I've got this home office that I can keep forever. And there's rules to that. There's rules to that. So sometimes you've got to make those inquiries. Was there permitted for planning or permit approval for that bungalow? You know, overcapitalizing on things that don't add value, if I could pick anything. If you're in a tenant-orientated area, a heavily tenant-orientated area, you know, you might look at things like a split system option for heating and cooling as opposed to ducted reverse cycle that's going to cost a fortune or hydronic heating or slab heating. You might not invest that in a tenant-orientated product. You might put one split system or wall-mounted air conditioning units or, you know, window furnishings that create good insulation. You know, so they don't have to spend money. Yeah, well, yeah, because things like the wear and tear of that split system is going to be dependent on its consumption. And you as an investor, if you can put you know, really good window furnishings. I'm not saying put sheer curtains in a tenant property that's going to cost you 10 grand, but if there's insulation techniques that you can do to prevent the wear and tear of product, you know, that can be an asset for you to allow for less maintenance.
Right.
And it could cost you cheap to do. Little things like that.
Yeah, you don't have to replace the air conditioner every 5 or 10 years if people are using it less because you've got the right window furnishings that insulate the home better.
Yeah. I remember staying in New York in an Airbnb and I kept on getting door knocked because I was there for 3 months by the landlord that lived downstairs saying, can you turn the air off a bit? Because yeah, they're paying for all the aircon. I said, it's boiling in here. I can't turn it off. I go, what you need to do, and I actually gave him the advice, is invest in better window furnishing so the heat's not coming in and I don't have to turn it on. You know, what's more important, you're spending $200 now on better window furnishings or paying the monthly aircon every time someone rents the property and then having to replace the aircon every couple of years because it burns out. So understanding that long-term play can be really handy.
Okay, that's fascinating. I'd never thought of that. I'd never thought that something as simple as a $200, they're going to have that much of an effect. All right. Now, the last thing that I really wanted to ask you today, because you've probably valued, oh, I don't know how many properties. How many properties would you have valued? How many tens of thousands?
Thousands.
Thousands of properties. And valuers often get a much closer pulse on the market than pretty much anyone else because you guys are valuing properties every day. You're seeing what the trends are. You're seeing what people are liking. You're seeing all of that stuff that's showing up in the sales data that doesn't, and you're seeing it with the sentiment that people have. It's not just data on a chart, but you actually get a sense of what people are genuinely looking for in different parts of the country or in different suburbs and how the market shifts in that way. I would imagine you guys have a much more acute sensitivity around market sentiment than even seasoned property investors and property professionals. So having put all of that pressure on you, what are the biggest hot buttons for property investors right at the moment? What are you seeing in Victoria and even more broadly, if you've got any intel on that?
Yeah, so there's two things there. Agents are really good to still communicate with. I don't underestimate the value of an agent because they hear when they're going through the homes, when there's those open house inspections, they're hearing what you know people didn't like about it. Oh, I don't like this lounge room. Or, I don't like the orientation. But we really needed that fourth bedroom. They hear all the negativity and all the positivity. So they understand those drivers. But as valuers, what we do really well and what we see is the risk. What is a lender and a credit team of a lender going to treat being really close to power lines? Because we hear the brokers, they contact us, oh, you've killed the deal because you said we're 150 metres from the power lines or we're 150 metres from the railway lines or, yeah, like that. We see the risk and what that's going to do to credit. Yeah, and the ability to get a loan or pour equity out of a loan. Yeah, for as an example, like it's something under 50 square meters in the apartment space can have a real detriment to equity. Yeah, because the growth sometimes isn't there because there's less buyers, and also the banks treat them differently on a risk perspective because they're smaller. You know, so understanding that on the valuer perspective is what we do really well, and understanding the risks. You know, we understand if you're buying an apartment in the CBD, which ones have cleaning issues at the moment, you know, and which ones don't. Well, each building is like its own suburb, and which ones have the issues. But what things I am seeing, like Art Deco is still very popular in Elwood and places like that in Melbourne, Armidale, all those period homes, I sought after locations next to train, rail, amenity, post office, school zones, all those properties are still performing really well. And sometimes people are buying just out the school zone, depending on where you are, in the prediction that one day it'll get extended with all the migration things that are happening. They're going, I could buy it cheaper now. I'm not going to send my school there. It's just an investment. I'm not sending anyone there. It's just an investment, but I'm going to land bank it in the expectation that it's going to extend, and then I'm going to be able to make severe uplift in years to come. Yeah, so there's people doing things like that. You know, I'm seeing that in Bentley and Bentley East. You know, the McKinnon school zone is extremely popular. A couple of years ago, just before COVID, I rented there because I wanted to do a dual occupancy site there. And I said, I just want to live in the landscape, see it, live it and breathe it. So I moved there while I could and actually lived and breathed it. I said, this is going to extend. This has to extend. And then COVID happened. I got locked in there and it did extend. Extended to Mackey Road and all those people got immediate uplift. You know, but what's happening now is just past Mackey Road, in between Mackey and Warrigal Road, those areas are booming now because they just can't afford to be in the school zone. So it's created an economies of scale that they've eventually lifted as well.
That is something that we're noticing a lot. We've got a lot of investors who've been investing in particular areas, and I mean, we use our AI tech to determine what are going to be the really good suburbs to be recommending and to be presenting. And they've all gone through a lot of growth over the last little while. And part of the way that the AI determines what suburbs want to be presenting is by looking at adjacent suburbs. That's one of the factors. And it seems to be a compelling one. It seems to be important. And so don't necessarily buy where the boom has just happened, but where it's about to happen. That's obviously,
there's risk to it, but there's reward. Risk versus reward. What I have noticed in the last 3 years that I really like is understand people like security and safety in terms of the streetscape. So, like, I've seen some really big premiums happen where it's in a single dwelling covenant street. So, you know that every neighbor is going to always be a house, it's tree lined. You know, there's no risk of an apartment complex or 8 units or people buying 2 blocks and consolidating them. They're always going to be a house. It's always going to be a period home. The heritage listed some of them. And you know that you can buy in confidence knowing that that's going to become a rarer and rarer and rarer commodity. And people pay a premium to get in there. You know, so that safety and security of knowing that the traffic congestion of that street is going to be maintained because there are always going to be houses with off-street parking. There's not going to be 2 units. Where it's now got increased street parking, they're buying that security. I've seen people pay a premium for that. And rather than build 2 units where they've got to go through town planning and go through that whole process, they're building a home instead and selling it because they're going, I know people are going to pay for it. I know it's a sought-after street. I know it's in the street zone. I know people are going to pay with confidence knowing that the street's maintained. And if I'm improving the integrity of that street, people will pay for it. So I'm seeing good uplift in that.
Yeah. So all you need is to have an investment property in a street like that, and for there to be 3 or 4 sales, you can pull the equity out. And that example you gave earlier was absolutely fantastic, where they bought it for 470, they spent 80 on it, they got it revalued at 730. All you really need is one, maybe 2 of those, and that can set up your entire portfolio. The equity that you can extract from that, if you can sort out cash flow, then the equity that you can extract from that can easily support another property purchase, maybe even 2. You get a couple of those and suddenly you're snowballing your portfolio and it turns into this, we do see people getting sort of 5 properties in 2-3 years kind of thing by being able to do exactly that sort of thing.
Exactly. And just when you do the DD on some of that stuff, like the diligence, what I've noticed when I was looking to buy a property, I'll use the suburb Ascot Vale as an example. I like that it was consistent. You know, it was close to amenity, train, good school, and they're all terrace homes as an example. So that ticked the box for me. I had a good abundance of comparable sales that I could rely on to see what the history had done for that area the last 3 or 4 years, and they're all the same. So that I had safety knowing that there has always been a good demand for the area, and there was pockets that were doing better than others. So I knew where I could buy, where I couldn't buy. Or what, depending on the risk I wanted, I could buy in the pocket less favored in the hope of uplift. Or if I wanted to live in it, I could buy where everyone wants to be. And I know that I've got that safety, right? But what was interesting was, I think it was 300 square meters. Yeah, it was the minimum lot requirement where you don't need a planning permit to renovate or extend, right? So if I had a 301 square meter block, I can go straight to building permit, which means upon settlement, If I did a 6-month settlement, I could organize my building permit, I could organize my architect, I could organize my trade, and the day I settle, I can start renovating. And there's a value to that, right? But if I was 298 square meters in that suburb, I'd have to go through the objection process, the town planning process. It could take 18 months before I could even start renovating. So that time where I've got to rent a property because I can't live in it, I've got to go through all that objection process, VCAT, go through all those council costs and delays whilst I'm paying the mortgage off. All these sorts of things can be time consuming and can suck out some of that profit. So sometimes you go, okay, if I don't mind waiting, I can get uplifted living in it for a bit while I go through that process, and then I can create a really good home, maybe get that home a bit cheaper than the 301 square meter, or I can go straight to the 301 because I know I've got my builders, I know I've got my trades, I know what I'm doing, I've done it before, and I can come in create some real value add in this area. I can look at what the market's paying a premium for, and I can make some good wins. An example where that hasn't worked. Do you want a quick example of where that hasn't worked?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. So I did a valuation where a person, again, I'm making up figures just to because I can't remember, it was ages ago, but they might have paid 1.2 for the property, right? It was really small block, might be like 200 square meters, same issue applied. You know, like a smaller block, you have to go through all that objection process and stuff. So and you're limited with what you can do with this terrace home. So someone's bought it in a COVID uplift thinking that the market's booming, it's gone up. Clearly it's gone up. It should be worth 1.5 now. They've gone to get equity out. I've come in at the exact same price they paid for it. So the owner is really upset now. He's giving me a hard time. The brokers are giving me a hard time. Please explain how everywhere in the media they're saying there's nothing but uplift and you've come in at the exact same price. And right, and the reason for that is, you know, why it didn't go up is all the comparable sale evidence a couple of years later from when he bought it, there was one that was extended. And there was one that had been enhanced and it didn't make much more money. And the reason is, you know, to go, they had a special building overlay over it, which was in that area was to deal with not flooding as such, but like water issues, drainage systems in the area. So any extension you have to do, you have to elevate the home. There's a cost associated to that. And when I looked at all the extensions and all the homes that did do that, you know, they did have to actually elevate the home. There's a big cost associated to it to go through town planning. Sometimes you have to put extra drainage. There was no relay and access. So how are you going to extend the home with cranes and all kinds of, there's street management, there's storage management. There's all these extra costs you have to do. And he was a two bedroom, one bathroom home. There was a three bedroom, two bathroom home up the road that only got $200,000 more. So how are you going to get uplift? So he paid a premium for something that's got a big cost to extend with constraints to be able to deliver that extension. So it's hard to get that uplift, right? And because it's only two bedroom, one bathroom, yeah, you lose a lot of small families. They outgrow really quickly. They're a corporate couple. They've got a kid now. There's no office. There's a nursery. So where do they do it? They outgrow it really quickly. So they move through it really quickly. So when that happens, you've got limited income, limited equity growth because they move too often. They don't become rare. They transact often enough where you can get another one. So they look at, is this one better than that one? You know, all that sort of stuff. There's less urgency to purchase it, and they outgrow them really quickly. The rental income's capped because you only got two bedrooms. You know, so the growth on the rental's capped as well. You can't really be too creative and extend and renovate because the size is so small. There might be a public, you know, not public open space. There might be a garden ratio that you have to maintain in the area, so you can only extend the home by a certain percentage, which limits what you can do, so then there's less growth. When you explain that, they go, oh, okay. You know, but it just looks like, oh, the market's gone up, therefore my property's worth more. Your property might be actually, you might have paid too much at the time to get into the suburb, and now it might have gone up, but it's just caught up to where you paid the premium for. And then it's going to take a lot longer for it to go up that next tier. So it's about buying smart as well.
Thank you very much for today, Anthony. It's been a really, really enlightening chat. I've learned so much that I didn't know before, and I've really, really enjoyed talking to you.
No worries.
So thank you very much. And we hope to see you on our podcast again sometime.
I look forward to it.
All right. Thank you very much. You have an awesome day.
No worries. Cheers.